Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
Somebody call Dave at 8183. Tell him the tornado's right over his house.
Yeah, I seen that.
This thing is massive. Oh my God. I was waiting for that microwave tower to go. Never did. Plug it into a plug-in.
Where?
Anywhere, right? First plug-in you see. You want that on tape?
Oh.
It is. Holy, oh my God, they're losing shingles now.
What's there to go?
It's right there.
Morgan,
yeah, Morgan, get downstairs.
It's okay.
I can't do it. Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Right. Thing sucks. You know, it's going to be a good day when it starts with vomit, Don.
Yeah.
It is 18 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of August in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along, making a part of your listening day, live from the plushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson radio program. I am he. Thank you for joining us today. It is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964, if you would like to engage with us telephonically speaking. Let me make sure the actual telephone is turned on. This one says, forget about the house. Sounds like that guy's losing shingles. That's true. There we go. All right. Yeah, somebody asked if there was more than one way to contact us via Skype. That is true, actually, if you've heard me say that. So there's the actual phone, which is just, you know, like a phone. It's 503-505-6964, but if you're on Skype, as many people are, you can send us a Skype message, or you can actually call us via Skype as well, which is that thing that Bruce Agler does sometimes where it sounds like he's in the room with us, and it sort of freaks me out, because it's like he's looming over our shoulders, like a big looming thing. Our Skype name is Rick Emerson Show. All one word, Rick Emerson Show. That's how you do that. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program here from high above the milk packing district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us. It's Wednesday. Coming up today, we have a double corpse watch, also religious nutcase watch today. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be joining us here in a bit. We'll talk about the Soapbox Derby, which is coming up, I believe, this weekend at Mount Tabor. Let's see what else. And we will talk. So this is a bit of a secondhand thing. So we'll be talking to Kelly, who will be talking about Aaron Mesh, who, via Kelly through us, will be talking about Scott Pilgrim, the movie. Which he saw, and which apparently he felt was filled with a population of unlikable jerks. In any event, that's coming up today. 503-505-6964 is our phone number. So we got a double corpse watch, a religious nutcase watch. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be doing not so much a mystery top five as we'll be spinning the hands of time. And I need some sort of a sound effect for that. Some sort of a... but not that. More of a bop-bop-bop-bop-bop-bop thing. You know, sort of a... You know, like a... like on Jeopardy, or on Tic-Tac-Doe, perhaps. Anyway, so we'll be spinning the wheel of time, and we'll be counting down the top five songs from June 25th, 1977. That's going to be coming up later on the day. June 25th, 1977. That is all on the way. And other things that seemed really crucial and important earlier today, but I realize now that to tease them in advance would just be foolish. So I want to really. Plus, I've already outlined so much stuff that it's like, You know, God knows if we'll get to half of that stuff, but we're going to do our best. We will endeavor to make all of that happen. Don't forget, you can also communicate with us in the text box, if you like, at rickemerson.com, or you can email us. That is rick at rickemerson.com or dawn at rickemerson.com. Speaking of Dawn Taylor, she's working on the following stories for you on this Wednesday afternoon.
Dick Cheney has been released from the hospital. A former world wrestling executive is one step away from the U.S. Senate.
You have something in your mouth?
Not really anymore.
Okay. It sounds as though you've had something in your mouth.
I just finished chewing and swallowing a bite of bagel.
When you say you just finished that, was that like 5 minutes ago or just now as you opened your mouth to speak?
I swallowed right before
okay.
I
just
came
checking.
On the mic.
No, I'm not saying you sound. I'm not saying it sounds bad in any way. I'm just saying you do have a little bit of a foodie sound to you.
Ah, well.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I don't usually eat a bagel during
that.
Usually soft, easily swallowed foods.
I wasn't criticizing.
And the bagel.
I was just making an observation.
The bagel's a little chewier than I normally do.
It's okay. It's all right. I'm sorry. So it sounds like we have a Cheney watch happening as well today.
I guess. Awesome. It didn't seem interesting enough to actually go for the whole watch.
Is it not thing. Interesting to you because he lived?
Partly,
he made it through.
We can make it a Cheney watch if you want. Let's make. I'll write the word
Thank
Cheney
you.
On top.
I appreciate that.
We'll make it a Cheney
All
watch.
Right. I'm sorry. And then there's something
it just
about
builds to... up expectations when we do it as a watch, and then it's like, he's out of the hospital.
I just
and
like
that's
to.
All there is, really.
I just like to amuse myself with the sounder. That's really what it's all about for me. It really is just an excuse to play the theme. All right.
And also, it's the first day of Ramadan.
Is it really?
It is indeed.
Say it, Ramadan.
Ramadan.
Dun, na, 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 na.
Ramadan.
Dun, na, na, na.
Ramadan.
Stop. Na, 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 na. Dun, na, 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 na.
And there you go.
It's Ramadan.
Da, 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 da.
I've got a new party game I can use all day long. All right. Hold on. I'm going to put that in everybody's head right now. Hold on just a second. It's Ramadan.
Da-da.
No, you don't satisfy it. You make them
do
the other half.
Oh, you make them do it in their own head. Okay.
Yeah, no, you
let's
just...
start again.
Okay, hold on a second. Let me just... anyway. So then the nun said, let's do it. The room's paid for. it's Ramadan. Awesome. All right. This is all true. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. Just so we can get all of this out in the open right here at the beginning of the program so you don't feel like we're trafficking in deception. I'm not saying Dawn's in a bad mood, but she was really late to get her coffee today. And I think, when did you ingest your first caffeine? Because did you wake up? Because here's the weird thing about this is, I don't even know where to begin. Because both of us, I think, at our separate homes, woke up and there was no coffee. There was no coffee at my place, and there was no coffee at your place this morning either. Less of an issue for me because I have the whole. In one of my many, many, many clothing wardrobes, I have the whole Viso stock that I keep there. So I was able to go it that way. But the problem is that I have this whole thing. Do you have something that you do at home, like a household, not a chore as such, but just something you do for Patrick, the night before, so he doesn't have to do it the next day. In other words, I set coffee for Lara every night, every single night, because she gets up before I do almost every day. So I will make coffee. I will put it and I'll set the timer and everything the night before. I don't know if you do anything like that, but I set coffee every night the night before. There was no coffee last night, which is something I discovered very late in the evening, and there was no time to really go to the store and get it. So it's that thing of when I went to bed last night, I was already bracing for a bad morning because I was waiting for her to come in this morning and say, there's no coffee! And sure enough, there wasn't. So my day started off sort of on a skittish note, not because I didn't have coffee, but because she woke up expecting coffee, and that's the worst. Like, if you know there's no coffee when you go to bed, at least you will wake up and you'll be aware of it. But if you're not braced for it, and she got up at 5 a.m. this morning to go to work. She got up at 5 a.m. to bicycle to work, and there was no coffee. And so my day started with her coming in and saying, so I've noticed that there's no coffee this morning. It seems like a reasonable person would have gone to the store last night knowing that somebody else in this family who makes the majority of the money had to wake up and bicycle to work at 5 a.m., and it's just like a whole, that was how my day started. It was all just a bit off kilter from the get-go. And then you woke up and there was no coffee to be had at your home.
Yeah, and then this was one of, my husband goes to work at different times depending on what day of the week it is. And today was a 7:45 day. And he works like a mile and a half from our house. So it's like, he can either walk there or I can be a mensch and jump into the car and spend 5 minutes and drive him to work and come back. So I did that.
When you do that, let me ask you this. Because I do this for Lara occasionally sometimes. If she's working at like 7, if she's working somewhat later in the morning, I will take her to work simply because it's a guarantee that I will be then up and around and out of bed and functional. It's a de facto alarm clock for me. It's like the Jetsons thing where it drags him out of bed and it sticks him in the shower and dresses him. So sometimes I will take her to work. But when you take Patrick to work, do you just do it in like your nightgown and your bunny slippers or whatever, or do you get dressed?
Well, generally I get dressed because usually I get up with him. And then, yes, this is the start of my day. Whether it's a 7:45 day or an 8:45 day or an 8:15 day, this is the start of my day. But this morning, I was just so tired, and there was no coffee. And I was like, so I got dressed like I was dressed, but I drove him to work. And then I was going to stop at McDonald's and get a large cup of coffee, but they charge $1.89. for a large coffee now, and I resent them for that because I know it costs like a nickel.
Right.
I know how much coffee costs.
Well, especially McDonald's. They're the definition of buying in bulk.
Yeah. And my other option was to go into 7-Eleven and buy a coffee, but it's like, you know, I haven't combed my hair, and it's 7:45 in the morning, and I really don't want to deal with, you know, convenience store people.
You don't want the convenience store clerk to think less of you.
Yeah, so I just went back home, and then realized now I'm home with no coffee. And it's like, I could make a cup of tea, and that's never adequate. So I just took my clothes back off and went back to bed for like an hour and a half.
Like sleep through the withdrawal.
Yeah. And then I got up, and then it was like, and I did some work at home, but it was like, I know that there's coffee at the office. So I packed everything up and came here, but I didn't get here until like 10:45. And then I immediately just like powered down 3 cups of coffee, like right in a row. So about the time you showed up, about a half an hour or so later, the caffeine was hitting. And you walk in and you're like, I'm in a bad mood. I'm like, I feel great.
I don't think I said that I was in a bad mood. I think you deduced.
Well, you said, I'm having a morning.
I'm having a bit of a day,
And I, of course, that was just like mere moments before the caffeine all hit my bloodstream. So then immediately I was like, Rick's in a bad mood. This is awesome.
This is what you actually said. This is how I was greeted this morning, where you actually said, I don't know, it's like, somehow, you know, when I'm in a bad, how did you phrase it? You said something very, because I was sitting here this morning.
It's something like when I'm in a bad mood, and then you come in and you're in a bad mood, and that somehow makes me giddy with
happiness.
That's
exactly what you said. Yeah, that's exactly what you said. You said, so, well, you know, sometimes, Rick, if I'm in a bad mood, but you come in and you're in a terrible mood, it makes me feel giddy and happy. And then you just gave me the biggest, brightest, beaming smile this morning. And as I was just sitting over here just making a list of people I'm going to kill later in the day, you know, perhaps before the show is even over, you know, and you're over there just bubbling over like Smurfette. You just could not possibly be happier. And your happiness is then being exacerbated and augmented by the fact that I'm having a terrible, terrible, terrible morning.
I'm like a hate succubus.
That's exactly what it is. It's like, this is the analogy I use all the time. You're like that guy from Hannibal who drinks the tears of children, except you drink the anger and the annoyance and irritation of Rick Emerson when he's having a bad day. I don't even want to talk about it. It's one of those things where I just flipped a circuit breaker in my head, and I just tried to be angry about so many things at once just now that I just shut down, and I went, nyeh. And I just sort of, and I went into a momentary sleep mode. No, it's not even that I'm in a bad mood as such. I mean, I guess I sort of am. I'm not in a bad mood like you are in the way when, like, your car, it gets is scratched, or you get, like, a big ticket on the way to work, or, you know, like your house caught on fire right before you were leaving to, you know, come to the office. It's not a thing like that. It's just, it was one of those days, because we all have, as Angela Chase said during My So-Called Life, she talked about how you have different compartments in your life. You know, you have your school compartment, you have your home compartment, you have the guy you're dating compartment, you have your social life and your friends compartment. Your life is divided into different sections. And on any given day, you expect of, let's say, the 10 different areas of your life. Like you, for example, you've got, you're here, you've got this show. Mm-hmm. You've got your cinematical stuff. Mm-hmm. You've got your life with your husband. You've got your social circle. You've got maybe the stuff, the other stuff you do for PDX with Bobby. You've got maybe other projects you're working on. You've got maybe, your family or whatever. You've got all these different areas. And you got to figure on any given day, maybe 20 or 30% of those areas of your life, people will just start to become crazy and unreasonable. You know, that you're going to have to deal with just some sort of insane drama on like one or two or three fronts. But then every now and again, the planets line up in just the right or wrong way. And every single element and facet and area of your life, everyone just goes crazy on the same day. Everyone just picks exactly the same goddamn morning to have some nervous breakdown or to foist all of their dramatic BS onto you. And by you, I mean me. And by some mornings, I mean today, this morning, where every single conceivable aspect of my life went wrong this morning. So, and there's no point in even discussing it because it's just like crap that only really matters to me. It just only affects me. But it was like this show and the whole thing with, you know, my wife waking up and there being no coffee. And there's the whole thing with my car that went wrong this morning. And then I got the, you know, this ongoing thing with the book that I've been working on. And I woke up. And do you ever do this too? Where you, this is the other thing. Do you ever wake up? And because, you know, in this electronic age, some of the times people you deal with, we're all scattered in different time zones. Do you ever wake up and you are already like 19 emails in to an email chain going back and forth between a whole bunch of people on which you are being CC'd? And it's some problem that started at like 4 a.m. Pacific time, but that was already like business time somewhere else. And there was already just some sort of figurative fire burning somewhere that everybody was freaking out about. And you wake up like you don't even have a chance to get the freak out like gradually. You wake up like ankle deep in the freak out because it's been going on back and forth and back and forth and back and forth all morning long while you slumbered peacefully under the mistaken illusion that things were going to be wonderful when you woke up.
Oh, indeed I have.
God damn.
I have editors on the East Coast, and so, yes.
You and me
I get up in the morning, and it's kind of like every morning it's like, is this the morning I discover I've been fired? The morning? What is waiting for me when I awaken?
It's that, you know, it's one of those mornings where I just wonder how much it would cost, like if I could just pay someone $50 to kill me and dump me in a ditch somewhere. I mean, you know, where you just want to, you just see passersby in the street, you go, sir, pardon me, sir, if I gave you my car in return, would you shoot me in the back of the head and then burn my body in a fruit cellar somewhere? Thanks, I'd appreciate that. God damn.
All right.
Oh, and then, just as a final whatever.
I'm just drinking all this up like a vampire, by the way.
I'm glad I can amuse. This thing, too, I got one of those mailboxes on the outside of my house that's not it's not horizontally aligned. In other words, you don't pull the thing down in the front and then reach your hand in. It's one of those top-down mailboxes where it is, you know, it's parallel to the wall of my home.
Okay.
Where the mail is set in from the top.
Hmm.
But as a result, and the mailbox is tall, it's like a foot, it's like 12 inches high. So as a result, and how many letters are 12 inches? Like almost nothing. So you have to reach your hand down inside. You can't. You know, it's difficult to see the mail. You have to reach your hand on the side. So sometimes, if somebody sends you like a thing, like a postcard, like if your dentist sends you, it's time for your annual cleaning, you may not see that thing for weeks after it arrives. Because if it's wet at all outside, the postcard will curl up, and it sits at the very bottom of the mailbox where you can't see it. So I'm fishing around inside to get the mail, this morning, I noticed this morning there was a letter we didn't get last night or whatever. So I'm checking, I see there was a stray envelope we missed yesterday, and I pull it out, and it's just like crap from Macy's or whatever, and, you know, it's like spam. And then I'm feeling around inside to see if there's anything else I've missed, and I pull out this tan postcard that's from the post office, and it's one of those, you've got a package waiting for you, sorry we missed you, and what do you mean? You think, hurrah, maybe someone has sent me a gift of some kind. Maybe Amazon has got an exciting product they sent me, and it's waiting for me at the post office. And then there's that thing where it says name of sender, and where it just says IRS. So there you go. So it's not even just a letter. I've apparently got a package of some kind. A letter that was some sort of item that was so large, they couldn't put it in my mailbox. And so the IRS has sent me something, presumably of some degree of urgency, they sent me however many days ago. I didn't want to look to see how long that thing has been sitting in my mailbox. So I guess sitting at the post office is just some crap from the IRS. And you know that'll be good news. Because
yeah.
The IRS, they can't wait to mail you and tell you something that you've been dying to hear. To tell you that your life is about to become better in ways you can't even imagine.
Maybe it's one of those giant cardboard checks.
Maybe.
And it wouldn't fit in the mailbox.
So, Anyway, so it's not that even that I'm in a bad mood. Because any one of these things would be a minor annoyance. Something going wonky with the book. Minor irritation. It'll get fixed. Some weirdness with the IRS. Okay, it sucks. Fine, but you'll figure it out. Some weirdness with this show, which, by the way, don't even get me started on the number of cables and prongs and cords and things that I was plugging and unplugging all night last night trying to fix this goddamned problem with the mobile stream versus the live stream. That or the coffee thing at home or the car or the fact that my tabs are expired and I still have to go get admission. Any two of these things. But no, all of them on the same day. So it is just, it's like the death of 1,000 paper cuts in my life today. Do you feel better, Dawn? Do you feel happy?
Strangely, yes.
Na 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 na.
It's Ramadan.
Na 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 na. All right, kids. This is all true. How was your night last night before you woke up and there was no coffee?
Mine was not bad. I went home and was home for a little brief period, and then I had to go back out to see a press screening of Eat, Pray, Love.
We talked about this yesterday. It's the Julia Roberts thing?
Yeah. And
that looks great, by the way. That looks fantastic.
Outside of a Twilight screening, I have never seen so many female movie patrons in one place. Except that these women all looked kind of alike. There was just this sort of soccer mom range.
An air of a vague mid-age desperation.
Yeah, from like 30 to 50 seemed to be the age. And there were almost no men, other than like the film critics I was sitting with and stuff like that. And and it's exactly what I thought it was going to be. It's a movie about an incredibly self-centered, privileged, rich white woman who has a couple of small dissatisfactions with her life, decides to just dump her husband for no really good reason, she just doesn't want to be married anymore, and then spends a metric buttload of money to go travel around the world for a year and find herself. And
does she find herself with the aid of people with amusingly exotic accents and foods that are served to her?
Yes. Well, the first third, the eat portion, is when she goes to Rome and she discovers that it's okay to eat pasta. And then she goes to India where she meditates and stuff. And then in the last portion, she goes to Bali. Where she meets Javier Bardem and learns that even though the important thing is to learn to accept and forgive and love herself without a man, she gets a man.
Oh, of course. Well, that is...
Spoiler alert. She ends up with a guy.
I forget who said this. Lara told me this at one point. I don't know whether she was quoting somebody else, but Lara has this whole thing about, you know, in films, whenever there are two or more women in a room, they must be discussing a man. That's just the way that it works. And this is the other thing. Whenever the moral of the story is purportedly that you don't need a man to make you happy, you will always end up with a man at the end of the film. That is the way that every movie like that works. Now, to be fair, that is also... I was going to say it's also true for guy movies, but it's not. It's really only true for guy movies that are meant for women. Where if it's... the moral of every guy movie meant for women is that, you know, even though he's a player and a Lothario, he really just needs the love of that one special woman. That's what all men want.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's do this without further ado. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program, I say, hoping like yesterday that I'm not introducing the wrong person. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week joining us now on the telephone.
Who's Kelly Clark?
Oh, damn you, Kelly Clark, and your rapier-like wit.
Damn you!
Yes. Hey, how are you on this Wednesday?
I'm doing great. How about you guys?
I'm dandy. Is it true you're going to be here in the studio later on today visiting a show that's not this one?
Yeah, I kind of messed things up. My Wednesdays usually belong to Rick Emerson and Dawn Taylor, but... that crafty Sarah tried to make me do it on a Friday, and I couldn't. And I'm sorry.
That's fine. It happened. It really is okay. Hey, you didn't go see Eat, Pray, Love by any chance last night at the critics' screening, did you?
No, unfortunately not. I want to stay as far away from those three things on a screen as humanly possible.
Excellent.
Actually.
All right. Excellent. Good for you. So I know you're on a bit of a timeline today. It's a busy day for you. But a couple things coming up in the new issue of Willamette Week that I wanted to talk about. One is, I think this is the first year that we have not done a lot of pre-discussion on this show about the Soapbox Derby, and that's because this is the first year that Sarah hasn't been part of it, I think, unless I'm missing something, because she and her friends put together some sort of death trap that rattles down the hill at like 1,000 miles an hour and cascades into a group of small children, and we will be denied that pleasure this year. But the Soapbox Derby is still going on, right? It's happening as per usual.
Oh, yeah. It's its 14th year, I believe. It's happening this Saturday. And we have a Q&A in the paper this week with Spencer Francois, who's actually part of the ArcaFork team. I'm totally murdering that name. It's ArcaForked. I don't know. ArcaForm. It's a North Portland antiques and home refurbishing firm, which apparently they just blow off their work for like an entire 2 months before the Soapbox Derby and create amazing, ridiculous, over-the-top soap derby cars. So they have done a Stegosaurus in the past, they've done a Lego car, and this year they're building a giant dog with an actual tail that wags and paws that move.
Here's the thing about the Dawn, have you been to the Soapbox Derby?
I never have. I've always wanted to, and I've never made it there.
It's awesome. It really is just...
It's so cool.
It's stunning. I mean, because there's different kinds of... I mean, there's different awards and different classes and prizes and whatever, and there are guys who go up there, and this is typically the guy part, where there are awards for fastest soapbox car, and those are really the ones that are just stripped down. They look like recumbent bicycles, sort of. They're just really streamlined. They're just sort of these sort of shells. But that's sort of just the side. That's just sort of the side competition for everybody else. The decoration and the design and the construction that goes into some of these things is just astounding. Last year there was a fully transforming Optimus Prime. I mean, it was a huge adult soapbox car, and they put it on a frame, and it's maybe 10 feet long by about 3-4 feet wide, and it was a truck, you know, and the deal is you start at the top Mount Tabor, and there's a driver who steers, and then there's like three guys who like hang on the side or who like ride in the back of it or something, and it was a truck, and then part of the deal is that it would like right at the starting line before they started rolling down the hill, it would go like wah, 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 and it would transform into a standing Optimus Prime and back again. It was I filmed it. It was freaking awesome. It was like the best thing I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
I just want one of those for everyday use.
It was really the follow up to that. Before we talk more about this, I have to mention this one too. And I don't know who did this. This was sort of a two shot. There was the transforming Optimus Prime, and then there was last year is not when Sarah did the Pope Mobile. Maybe that was last year. I don't know. But there was one where it was just a sort of basic frame where it was just the four wheels and then a bed, and then in the middle of it was a bunch of skyscrapers, and they were, I don't know, maybe 7-8 feet tall. Looked like they were built with sort of plaster and the paper mache or whatever you call that stuff. But it was, you know, whatever, like plaster and muslin and stuff, and it's put together, and it was just sitting at the starting line, and you're thinking, well, it's just a bunch of buildings on a frame with wheels. Like, what is the point of that? And then the guy with the starting flag is going like 5, 4, and as he's counting down, I swear to God, from out of the wilderness, from out of the trees, runs a huge guy in a King Kong outfit, and he leaps onto it and begins climbing the skyscrapers and reaching inside and like holding up like a Fay Wray doll or something as it begins rolling down the hill. And it's rolling down the hill, and he's going like, you know, or whatever, making like a King Kong noise and waving the thing. And it was awesome. And I was thinking, well, that's fantastic. So second round, that building, because, you know, we qualify for a second heat or something. Second heat, the building is standing there. Same thing again. It's the four wheels, it's the frame, and it's the skyscrapers. And I'm thinking, okay, well, they've the King Kong thing is going to run out. Okay, I get it, you know. And as the guy's counting down, 5, 4... Same guy, presumably, huge Godzilla suit, runs out of the trees, leaps onto it, and then begins kicking the buildings over, like as the thing begins rolling down the hill. It was, and you're saying to yourself, like, my God, the amount of time and energy and brain power that went into that. It really just, it was one of those, like, Portland is the greatest city in the history of mankind moments. So anyway, so I'm interrupting Kelly as she's talking about, but so your Q&A is in this... Is in the Willamette? Did they give you any?
It's in this issue. And so, if you've ever been to Soapbox Derby, you've probably seen these people's work. They've been doing it for the last 6 years, and so it's kind of just a little peek behind how they actually get everything all you know, how they think it all up. And basically it comes down to they go drink at the Alibi and come up with ideas and cocktail napkins and then just spend 2 months just building these crazy-ass things. But I think this is pretty much the same process for anybody who builds anything good at Soapbox Derby. And then they spend about $150 on PBR.
I mean,
this is the secret to an amazing Soapbox Derby car. So.
And they do spend, people just spend the entire winter and spring sometimes building these things, especially if they're going to be, they're over the top. And then you go there and, you know, it's usually, this year's going to be different. It's usually really hot and everybody is unbelievably drunk. And it really is, and it just, and there's thousands and thousands of people, it seems like. Have any idea what the attendance at the Soapbox Derby is?
You know, I don't. I emailed the organizers and didn't get an answer back on that. So I'm just going to say a lot. That's a technical term.
I mean, it's just a ton of people, and it's a long day.
People.
Yeah, and you may not want to.
But they changed the rules this year. They're not allowed to throw water balloons at anybody this year, apparently.
Oh, that's just not right.
Yeah, I know. Way to take out all the fun just in the name of not killing people.
That's not right. All right, so we got that going on, and then this is sort of a weird thing. So now we are speaking to you, and you, by proxy, will be conveying the thoughts of Aaron Mesh regarding a guy named Scott Pilgrim, who is the lead character in a film that I haven't seen. So please now to do that.
Yep, the easiest way to explain this is this sentence written by Mr. Aaron Mesh. Is it possible to like Scott Pilgrim versus the world if you want to kick Scott Pilgrim in the nards?
And the answer is?
That would... yes. The answer is yes. You can love the movie, well, or at least really like the movie, think it's inventive and interesting and really visually appealing, and hate Scott Pilgrim. He thinks he is a bastard man-child who doesn't deserve to have any woman, hates him with a passion. So, really, basically, it's a movie full of Michael Cera being Michael Cera and fighting evil exes and kind of being a schlub. But around that is a visually just a visual banquet of awesomeness. So he says, totally go see it. Just don't expect to like Michael Cera.
And I will say that I know very little about this because I haven't ever read the comic on which it's based. And I told Dawn, actually, I think I was saying to you last week that I preemptively disliked the film just because it was one of those things that fanboys had just been gibbering about so relentlessly online for months and months in advance. To the point that I was just sort of predisposed to be suspicious of it because I figured that it would either A, be such a mainstream watered-down version of the thing that it was pointless, or it would be completely faithful to the source material and exactly what the fanboys wanted, which is always a guarantee that no one else will like it. But it sounds like they sort of straddled the middle somehow on it.
You know, but I've stopped being angry at the fanboy things because, come on, I mean, you got excited over Battlestar.
I'm not saying that, but don't get me wrong. I am for something being completely faithful to the source material. It's just that I recognize, though, that if you are not a huge fan of that, in other words, if you're not in the initial core group, the odds are pretty high that you will feel a little bit on the outside. You may not get the big deal with it.
The thing with Scott Pilgrim, though,
that is very true.
Yeah, the thing with Scott Pilgrim, though, is that, yeah, it is very faithful to the source material, and it's one of the better, more faithful adaptations of a comic that I've ever seen. But the thing is, it really does start at the beginning and go all the way through the so far five books of the series and tell you that entire story. So you don't have to know anything. You don't have to have insider information. You don't have to be, you know, one of the fanboys to actually walk in cold and see it. It presents the story from, you know, beginning to finish right for you.
So it's
and
not one of
the... You yourself can figure out whether you want to kick them in the nards, right?
Yeah. And you agree with the whole thing that it's visually sort of, that it's visually engaging?
Oh, yeah. It's a terrific film. And Aaron's absolutely right. It's even in the comics as well, though. It's not just Michael Cera. The character is written that way. He is a kind of a unrealistically egocentric sort of ineffectual, unemployed slacker. And he's not a particularly lovable character.
You know, it's funny. Actually, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kelly.
No, go.
I was going to say, it's funny that you say that because it's weird, actually, if you were to sort of excerpt the way you just described him as being an artificially exaggeratedly egocentric character who, you know, with no girlfriend and a slacker and whatever, and Michael Cera. So as a movie I just began watching, and I had to, for reasons that I don't even remember now, I had to stop at like 20 minutes in. I'm going to continue it maybe tonight. A reason I just began watching the film adaptation of Youth and Revolt. And Youth and Revolt is – certainly in the book, and I'm presuming in the movie, he's exactly the same, where Nick Twisp is this unbelievably intelligent, you know, and almost villainously egocentric, dateless loser, you know, who is angered and who is angered and frustrated by the fact that he is smarter than everyone around him, and yet doesn't really ever seem to accomplish much, but expends a great amount of energy and vocabulary not accomplishing anything.
I actually watched that exact same movie this weekend. So,
and yeah, so see, I'm a massive fan, an unbelievably huge fan of the book, and I'm just now I just now have steeled myself to sort of wade into the movie. I've gotten to the point where whether it's good or bad, it doesn't really matter.
I don't know. Michael Cera needs a good serial killer role or child rapist or. I don't know. It's something new. Something that it doesn't involve chocolate, you know, chocolate dipped bananas or mooning over girls.
Well, that's kind of his thing. Is he had mooning is exactly the right way to put it too. He has become the sort of elliptical mooner, in terms of his in terms of interactions with other people. But they do need to reverse it at some point, and they need to give him, as you said, just a role where he's. It's like when that guy from Blue's Clues, played a murderer on Homicide, which I think was solely like his whole point was just to demonstrate to the world at large that he wasn't just the guy who sat around and talked to an animated dog.
Yeah, but sometimes it doesn't work because then all the Robin Williams movies, then he's just creepy.
Yeah.
And you're like, ew, I don't want that creepy, hairy, short man around me. Sometimes it doesn't work. Maybe this is all he has to give us. And granted, he gave us Arrested Development, so I'm not going to complain.
Well, there's something to be
George
said
Michael.
For, I guess, not unlike AC/DC, if you can do one thing but do it very well, I guess, there are worse careers to have, you know? I guess, Don and I were talking about Brendan Fraser at one point, and you were saying that you were frustrated that Brendan Fraser, who you thought was a very gifted actor, didn't really stretch himself more, he just went for the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
And my whole thing is, you know, but maybe he just doesn't care. Maybe his whole thing is like, look, I could either be pouring concrete in Akron, Ohio, or I could just be working, like, very, very gently to make these, lowest common denominator movies for which I am paid millions of dollars, and I'll just do the second one. You know, like, if you can exert yourself, like, the bare minimum and still be a star, why not? There you go.
I'm just trying to think of what Brendan Fraser stretching himself would look like, because I keep coming up with Monkey Bone, and that's not anything anyone should ever see.
Well, Gods and Monsters is a good example. He was.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think it's a lot easier. You know, if you can do that, or if you can just stand against a blue screen and stare at your watch for 90 minutes while they film you, and then they just stick in Mummy 9 stuff behind you, then, you know, and then you cash the check and go home and just spend the rest of the evening watching SportsCenter. I mean, it's. If I could do that for a living, I would not be here. Let's be honest right now. I'm not going to traffic in lies. I wouldn't be here speaking to you. All right. So the new issue of Willamette Week on stands right now and available at WWeek.com. I don't know, I may or may not run into you this afternoon when you're here, but if not, thank you for carving some time out of your hectic day, Kelly Clark.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
Thank you. There you go. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week, ladies and gentlefolk. There you go. All right. Monkey Bone. All right. I'm going to file the editor things.
Bone.
You know what I never saw? I never saw Monkey Bone. I never saw George of the Jungle. I never saw. What was that? Do you ever realize you can't remember if you've seen a movie or not because you've seen the preview so many times that you think you've seen the movie?
Yeah.
I can't remember if I've seen that Blast from the Past thing with him and Alicia Silverstone.
You would probably remember Christopher Walken from that if you ever have, because Christopher Walken played his father and he was delightful.
I don't know.
Blast from the Past is a movie that people either... I've met a number of people who just really hate it, and I don't understand why, because I find it delightful. I really, really enjoyed that movie. Monkey Bone, do not see Monkey Bone. Don't ever see Monkey Bone. Ever, 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 ever.
It wasn't really in danger of happening, just FYI.
George of the Jungle, on the other hand, not that bad.
Are you kidding me? Well, not when you say not that bad, you mean not as bad as Monkey Bone?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not unwatchable, let me put it that way. And there are some things in it that are actually quite entertaining.
All right, then. Real quickly, just on the Youth and Revolt thing, I should say this, it is like months and months after the fact. But I got just so many emails when Youth and Revolt was coming out because for years on this show, I mean, I think since, well, the book came out in 95, 96. So probably since this show debuted in Portland in 1998, literally since the beginning of this show in Portland, people have heard me lecture them tirelessly, ad infinitum and ad nauseum, about Youth and Revolt and why it's like the greatest novel in the history of the world and why you got to read it. And I would just – I would force it on people and I would give it to the – I've told this story before, but that actually I think two or three Christmases in a row, it was the only thing I gave to people because I'd ask if they'd read it. And if they hadn't, I would just give it to them again. And I told them, I said, I'm going to keep giving this to you every Christmas until you read it. So you're never getting another gift from me until you've read it. So it's up to you, friend. Sometimes that worked out. Sometimes it didn't. I gave it to Court and Bobby, who just loathed it.
I'd like to read it because I didn't really care for the movie, but I could tell from the film that there was some really interesting stuff there that perhaps was presented in a much more interesting.
Yeah.
Because, again, if, you know, books and movies are very, very different. You lose, you know, the entire, you know, temper and and rhythm of the language.
Yeah.
You lose POV if, you know, depending on in a book like that, where I guess you are seeing everything from a specific character's point of view and kind of on the outside looking in a film. Yeah. And so I'd like to read the book because the movie didn't really do much for me. But the idea, the concept is really intriguing. The characters are intriguing.
I'm about 15 minutes into the movie right now. And I will just say, this is a long way of saying that for everybody who emailed me about it when the movie came out, they're like, OMG, the Youth and Revolt is a movie that, you know, that, and it seemed probably conspicuous that I didn't see it. And it was just because I just knew in my heart somehow that it wasn't going to be very good. And I don't know. So I'm watching it now. And it does seem like it seems like the best of both, the best and worst of both worlds, I guess, in that it seems faithful, but in the sense that it's just a very, very hyper-compressed version of the book. So who knows, because not to bore anybody with the minutiae, but the book they're basing it on, Youth and Revolt, is actually in and of itself three smaller novels that the author wrote separately. This guy, C.D. Payne, wrote three novellas, stitched them together when he was done into one big novel, which they have now compressed into one film. So it's just that thing of trying to put too much mud in a small sack. And, you know, it seems like it's going to be a decent film, but not great. At some point, if you want to read it, I'm not going to go on and on about it because it's, you know, whatever. The movie's been made. You know, that's checked off the list. If you ever want to borrow it, I've got like 12 copies at home because I keep them there. I keep them there. I actually keep spare copies of Youth and Revolt around just to lend to people. So that way, if I don't ever get it back, it doesn't really matter. So at this moment, I've probably got 5 copies in hardback just sitting at my house just waiting to be given out. So I have a lending library basically, but only for that book. It just sort of...
I would indeed like to borrow it. So I recently forced that book on you about the...
Which I'm reading right now.
Oh,
Stylized. A slightly obsessive history of strunken white elements of style. I'm reading it right now as we speak. So now you're morally obligated to read something I give to you.
There we go.
And I do the Adama thing, too. The Bill Adama thing of, I don't lend books. You know, where I just... All right. I wish I was dead.
Now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Well, I just stumbled across this and feel the need to share. As part of Denny's new value menu revamp, for the low, low price of $4, you can get a new sandwich called the Denny's Fried Cheese Melt, in which 4 fried mozzarella sticks are embedded inside an American cheese grilled cheese sandwich between 2 slices of sourdough, which is then grilled. And it's served with French fries and a side of marinara sauce. So basically, here we go. You have a grilled cheese sandwich, a sandwich that is made of cheese, filled with sticks of deep fried cheese.
I know. Just hearing you say it out loud that way makes it even funnier.
There's a photo of it, a cross section of your deep fried cheese, grilled cheese sandwich.
And the headline is Denny's new fried cheese sandwich is culinary terrorism. You think we've entered a stage of irreversible hyperbola in this country or something?
Yeah.
Here's the thing is I honestly don't know how I feel about that. I really and I know that sounds a bit daft, but I don't know whether I find that appetizing or not. I might. Do I?
I can't tell
anymore. I don't know anything anymore.
I saw this via Gawker, which also has a piece on the chain Friendly's.
Uh-huh.
They now have something called a mac and cheese quesadilla, which is a cheese quesadilla filled with macaroni and cheese.
All right, that I don't want.
Which you can add bacon or a hot dog to. With a drink and the dessert that comes with it, if you have the meal, it's 2,300 calories.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not.
All right. That's insane, is what that is.
America.
I mean, that's not madness, and it's not Sparta. That's just insane. Here's the thing about because the macaroni, and the reason I say that is not because of the calorie count, but it's that you're expending that many calories on something that doesn't even sound good.
Considering that's hundreds and hundreds more calories than you should be eating in an entire day.
Well, that's more calories almost than an MRE. Those meals ready to eat. And those are actually predicated on the fact that it may be the only meal you get for like a day or two.
And you're marching around in like the jungle.
So the thing about the Denny's sandwich with the mozzarella sticks in it, like that doesn't actually sound that bad. Because if you think about it, in essence, what are they doing? They're just putting a little bit of breading and some extra cheese into a grilled cheese sandwich. It's not like they're really even augmenting it all that much. That really is just like they're adding a little breading on the inside. The other thing, the quesadilla and the macaroni and cheese, that's just two foods that don't go together at all. And I know there's lots of things that you wouldn't think would go together that do. That's not one of those combinations. That just seems repellent. So I will go to Denny's and have the other thing, though, just so I can report back to everybody. Hey, is that... This is a thing that I think happened while I was unemployed, and so therefore something worth doing off the radio is not worth doing. If I can't come and just sort of make grist out of it, then what is the point? Right before we got fired at KUFO, they launched that, what is it, the double down, double decker thing?
The double down sandwich at KFC, yes.
But they didn't have it here in Portland. Hmm. And then they rolled it out in Portland, but I was off the air, so what's the point? I kind of missed the window where it was new and available and I was on the air. All three of those things didn't sync up. Now that it's out, is there any point in me actually having it?
Why not? I mean, I bought one once just to see what it was like. Then I took it with me to a movie screening and forced it on some of my film critic friends. I was like, look, it's a double down sandwich. And they went, and I'd go, try it.
Relative to fast food, was it good?
Oh, yeah, it's delicious.
Okay, awesome.
How can it not be delicious?
Well, because
it's two pieces of Kentucky Fried Chicken with cheese in the middle.
Because I read some reviews where people said, they said, I love chicken, I love cheese, I love junk food. They said, but it just didn't end. They said it ended up being kind of bland. The reason why it wasn't even really tasty relative to the genre.
Well, it's not as delicious as the KFC Sadness Bowl.
No. Well, what is really?
Shocking terror beyond your imagination. Wednesday 13 in I Walked with a Zombie.
If I do, when I'm dead, if I don't.
is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us today. Still to come, we have today's top five as we rotate the Wheel of Time. We'll have the top five from June 25th, 1977. June 25th, 1977. For the folks who ask in the text box, what we were just hearing just now, the science fiction double feature thing, that is Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. However, before that was Wednesday 13. Wednesday 13, the band behind the creepy Death Bunny Cemetery corpse shirt that I was wearing that freaked you out last week.
So, it was a great shirt, but it was a little startling.
Just FYI, Lara hadn't seen that either, and so I wore it home that day, and she looked at it, and then she asked me to throw it away later. She said, please burn that shirt or throw it away or make sure that it's no longer in our home. That's not going to happen, by the way, but just in case I should come to work grouchy because that shirt has vanished, you will know that she's the one responsible for that, just so you know. All right.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A Tenino, Washington man arrests... Oh, I started reading before I said, this is our double corpse watch.
How do you feel about your failure in that regard, Dawn?
I'm miserable
about
it. Let's
try this again.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Hey, Rick.
Hey.
We have a double corpse watch.
Are you sure?
I am indeed.
All right, here's your corpse watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Show, Wednesday.
I'm digging up bones, I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
Are you scratching your foot with the other foot?
Yes.
It's funny that I can't see anything from below about mid-chest level on you. Mm-hmm. I can't see your legs or your feet, but just from the expression on your face just now, I deduced that you were scratching one foot with the other.
I was indeed.
Okay, there you go.
A Tenino, Washington man arrested in connection with a woman's slaying says he found her body, had sex with her corpse, and then was planning to dump her body, according to court documents. Bernard Howell, 26, appeared in court Monday after he was pulled over with a woman's body in his truck on Sunday night. Deputies said Howell killed the victim on the Yelm Tenino Trail near Highway 507, but Howell said he didn't kill her. He only found her body.
He only found it and had sex with it.
A man said Howell approached him and asked if he would help dispose of a woman's body. Shortly after, the man flagged down a deputy at about 8:15 p.m. and said there was a man who was attempting to move a body. The deputy pulled the suspect's pickup truck over near Parkside Elementary School. Documents said Howell did not immediately pull over, but he did not resist once he stopped. He asked if there was a body in the car, and he said, yes, there was, said Jim Chamberlain of the sheriff's office. So the police officer asked if there was a body in the car, and the guy said, why, yes, there is.
Now, was the body in the trunk, or was it in the back? Was it in the seat?
It was in the back seat of his pickup truck, so he has one of those double cab pickups,
right,
apparently.
But I mean, in other words, I wonder if the cop is looking at the body and then asking the guy, hey, there wouldn't happen to be a body in your car.
Well, he had been, he had been tipped off by this other man. It's like, hey, this guy told me he wanted to help getting rid of a body. Pulled him over.
Do you have anybody, other than presumably your husband, that you would ask to help you dispose of a body?
Sure.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Who would you ask?
I'd ask my friend Frank.
Really?
Yeah, Frank would be good at something like that.
Do you think that if you had killed someone and you had a body you needed to dispose of, do you think if you asked Frank to help you get rid of the body that he would do it?
It would depend on the reason. He would want to know why I had a dead body, and I think that if I had a convincing enough reason, if I said, you know, this guy broke into my house and was trying to kill. You know, I don't know. If I had some good reason for wanting to dispose of the body, if it sounded plausible, I believe he would help me, yes.
Let me ask you this. What if you just went over to Frank's house and you didn't have the body as such? Let's just say you went over to Frank's house and you had, let's say, a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe like a tire iron, that looked as though it had been recently scrubbed. And you said, look, I need you to keep this in your house and don't tell anybody that it's here. Would he do that?
Yeah,
if you didn't
might.
Give him any other additional information at all.
He might. He has a lot of guns of his own, so he'd probably be understanding about the whole gun thing.
Well, that's a good guy to know.
Of course, I wouldn't do that, though. I would dispose of it in some other fashion.
Throw it off the bridge.
The many ways that you can dispose of things,
Throw it off the bridge and not here. You throw it off a bridge in Silverton.
Right. Exactly.
Here's Dawn Taylor.
Anyway, so the deputy pulled the suspect's pickup truck over, said, "Hey, you have a body in the car?" And he said, "Yes, indeed, I do." The officer checked a sleeping bag in the backseat of Howell's pickup truck and found the body of a woman in her late 50s. He basically said he was trying to save the woman's family from paying for a funeral, Chamberlain said, yet we can't find the evidence of how he knew who this woman actually was. According to court documents, Howell claimed he found the woman bloody and dead, then had sex with her corpse, and decided to drive her car to his home to bring back a sleeping bag, zip ties, and a 10-pound weight, and was going to dump her body in a swamp.
Well, the bizarre thing is, it's like you almost want to believe the guy in the sense that why would you admit to violating a corpse and planning to get rid of it and then not just also cop to killing her? Unless, again, back to the dumb criminal thing we always talk about, unless he was under the impression that the murder would have such a disproportionately higher sentence attached to it than the violation.
He said, well, they're going to be able to tell that I had sex with it.
I mean, is there a picture of the corpse?
No.
I mean, let me ask you this. Is there a picture of the woman before she was a corpse?
No. They haven't actually identified who the woman is.
That's got to be one attractive woman.
They haven't said.
She's got to be, I mean.
Well, she was in her late 50s. So, I don't.
Don't be ageist, Dawn.
I don't think if you have sex with a dead person, it's really about the actual attractiveness of them. Much like rape is not about, like, a woman being attractive. You know, having sex with a corpse is not really about how pretty it is.
You're wrong on all counts here. You couldn't be more. Look, if I took this guy into a room and I showed him five corpses, four of them ugly, one of them hot, and I said, "You got to have sex with one of these. I know you've been looking to do it," so he's going to pick the good-looking one.
Well, sure, if you give him a variety of corpses from which to choose.
Yeah.
But I think if you gave him, say, the option of having sex with a live woman or a corpse, the guy who chooses the corpse is not choosing that predicated on the attractiveness of the woman. It's because they've got some kind of a screw loose and want to have sex with a corpse.
Well, okay. All right, I could see that. No, and I guess maybe, I can't even believe we're having this conversation, but I guess maybe... necrophilia, as opposed to rape, I guess there's in a strictly logistical sense, you have far more opportunities for the latter than the former. In other words, necrophilia, you either got to find a corpse, and like, mm-hmm. How often does that happen? Twice a year, tops.
Hardly ever.
Or you got to create a corpse. Mm-hmm. And that just involves a whole bunch of, you know, like going to prison or whatever. And this guy, you know, who knows, maybe he did it or maybe he didn't. Maybe it's like
and
a friend of
And depending on
his,
how you do
you know,
it afterwards, you're going to be awfully tired.
That's the thing, too. And if she struggles. So maybe this is the thing that we're like, he has some nutcase friend that killed the girl. Maybe it's this. Hold on. Okay. Maybe he had a friend who killed the girl, gave him the body to dispose of. And then he instead just said, well, why dispose of it?
Hey, free girl.
Yeah. And then, you know, but then it's on him. And then he's like, oh, crap. And now I still got to get rid of it. Garbage. So, I'm just speculating. Okay. Well, and that was where? In Washington State?
That was indeed.
All right. Behold the glorious Northwest. Is that the end of the Corpse Watch?
No, we have another Corpse Watch.
Jesus, sorry. God almighty, what kind of world is this?
The operator of a New York subway train that ground to a sudden stop when a woman fell between its cars overlooked her body while searching the track bed and then resumed the trip, running over her with another six cars. The New York Post reported that then 10 more trains passed over her remains before anyone noticed.
I wonder if at one point she was just thinking, well, this day can't get any worse.
The tragedy unfolded as Arabelle Lynn, 25, who had a prosthetic right leg, was walking between the cars of a subway train on March 28th. After she fell, she hit a device on one of the cars that triggers the emergency brake when the train encounters an obstruction. The operator, whose name was not released, got out of the cab, spent 7 minutes walking up and down the track, looking under the cars, and then climbed aboard and continued the trip. Police interviewed the operator, who said he was unaware that someone was stuck under the train. But investigators who reenacted the incident determined he did not spend enough time searching.
Well, you're not supposed to be walking between the cars of the subway.
No.
I mean, that's just the thing. You're not supposed to do, I mean, prosthetic leg or not. There's a big sign there that says, don't walk between the goddamned cars. You know why? Because it's between the cars. You are in a sort of non-supportive space there. So does it say whether, so did she fall between the cars?
I think she got stuck. Her prosthetic leg, I think, caused her to like get her foot caught or something like that, and she triggered an emergency brake thing, and I'm not sure what happened, but
we've all got
problems.
But
anyway,
well, that's your own fault. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you disregard the sign that says don't walk between the cars, bad things happen to you. So
ten more trains ran over
Well, that's to teach her a lesson.
Yeah.
You know, that's just for good measure. That's just running up the score. All right, there's your double corpse watch for Wednesday.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones.
Someone in the text box seems to believe that there's an overabundance of sex with corpse discussion on the show.
No more than usual. Wait, does he mean as compared with the outside world?
I think he means like compared to other radio shows, perhaps.
Well, that's... we have a corpse watch. You... all right, whatever. I mean, you realize that this is a show where this follows a penis watch and leads into a cannibal watch, right? I think the idea of decorum can be safely left at the door. All right. The only reason I ask about the photo of the woman is we had the story last... maybe a year and a half ago, where it was like two brothers and like a guy who lived down the street all went and to a cemetery and dug up some chick who died the week before because they saw her photo in the paper and decided she was really hot and that she would be incapable of sufficient resistance once she was,
well,
you know,
yeah,
dead and buried. So, and you just wonder, like, who had the idea? And how did he sort of raise the issue to the other two while they
maybe they'd seen that movie Dead Girl.
No, I think it was pre-Dead Girl, actually.
Was it?
This is before you decided to traumatize me by showing me the sex with a zombie,
yeah,
the movie that really, it's one of those things that was that's a great movie that I'm never going to watch again. Ever, 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 ever. I will never watch that movie again.
Well, some things never don't need to be seen a second time.
You are a horrible person. This is Dawn Taylor.
From heat waves in the U.S. and Russia to flooding in places like Pakistan, it's been a summer of weather extremes around the world. Is it just a coincidence, or are they somehow linked?
It's a coincidence.
Well, NASA scientist Tom Wagner says it's more than just coincidence.
Oh, well, fine. If a guy from NASA says that, whatever. Is that one?
Why couldn't they get William Borucki to talk about this?
I don't know.
Yes,
I think the biggest thing, of course, is the fact that we find so many candidates. We have over 700. We believe about half of those will probably turn out to be planets.
Here's the less interesting guy from NASA.
All these things are the kinds of things that we would expect to happen as the planet warms up. And what we're seeing is that overall, the planet's warming about 0.35 degrees per decade.
We need to look through these candidates with ground-based telescopes and find out which are really planets and which aren't.
It's just the pause there that sells everything for this guy. All right.
Oh, Wagner says it's because the planet is warming up.
All these events, from heat waves to stronger monsoons to loss of ice from around the world, they're all consistent with that. Where it gets a little bit tricky, though, is assigning any one specific event to say, oh, the cause
Ed
of
Norton,
this event is definitely global warming.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part where he said the...
All these events, from heat waves to stronger monsoons to loss of ice from around the world, they're all consistent with that. Where it gets a little bit tricky, though, is assigning any one specific event to say, oh, the cause of this event is definitely global warming.
Well, that doesn't make sense, though, because if his whole claim is that the planet, which I believe the last time I checked is the same thing as a globe, if his whole thing is that the planet is warming up, but it's not caused by global warming, that doesn't make any sense. That is a non-internally sustainable statement he's making there.
Apparently, he says that it's not a coincidence that all these things are happening, considering the planet is warming at a rate of about 0.35 degrees per decade.
We're seeing things that haven't really ever happened on this planet before, like warming at this specific rate. And we think it's very well tied to increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since the late 1800s.
So we're seeing things like the planet warming, but it's not caused by global warming. That makes no sense at all. This is, exhibit 795, my contention that people don't know what they're talking, that even scientists are just making stuff up. All right. Well, there you go. There's that guy who's just not nearly as interesting as
this
guy.
We need to look through these candidates with ground-based telescopes and find out which are really planets.
Planets.
And which aren't.
Or really not even as interesting as a...
If you do squish it, it does have a reaction. It emits an acid that can cause, like, dermatitis to people.
Or really even this guy.
We do not pay taxes for y'all to spray our kids in the face. That's ridiculous.
All right, here's Dawn Taylor.
It's the first day of Ramadan.
Da-da-da-da-da.
It's Ramadan.
Da-da-da-da.
The most ancient traditions of Islam are going high-tech with a slew of modern offerings for those observing the holy month of Ramadan. Cell phone applications such as iPray or iQuran offer a beeping reminder of requisite prayer times, while the Find Mecca and Mosque Finder programs help Muslim travelers in unfamiliar cities find the nearest place to pray.
Would you like to? Would you like for me to just do this whole thing again as though I were Dennis Miller?
Sure.
All right. So just read just the second section there about the technology and the whatever, and I'll do it as though I was I'll respond as though I was Dennis Miller.
Cell phone applications such as iPray or iQuran offer a beeping reminder of requisite prayer times, while the Find Mecca and Mosque Finder programs help the Muslim traveler in an unfamiliar city find the nearest place to pray.
Based on recent events, it seems like the biggest seller in that application store ought to be the Eye for an Eye application. Chachi.
James Otung.
Eye for an eye. Get it?
Yeah.
Fine. Whatever. Just dismiss my wit.
James Otun, who has several Islamic applications on his Apple iPhone and iPad, said, "When I saw these applications for the first time, I thought, this is amazing. Whoever came up with this idea, God bless him or her." There are also Islamic-themed programs that help users find the nearest Costco, which offers foods prepared according to dietary rules, learn the correct Arabic pronunciations in a daily prayer, or count how many pages of the Quran they've read that day, all on their mobile phone.
Is there one that can calculate the number of rocks required to stone a given homosexual? That'd be handy. I'm just saying that is a thing that, you know, that the religion of peace could probably find a useful application for. I'm just saying.
Not all Muslims are running around stoning people.
Really?
Really.
Is that the – no, I mean, I understand that, but I'm saying is that – I understand that not all Muslims are doing that. That's the that wasn't really the source of the humor there. You're missing the missing the crux of the joke.
It's Ramadan.
Da 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 da.
It's Ramadan.
Da da da. Da.
Right. Got any questions about Ramadan? I've got a whole thing here about
less than you could possibly imagine.
Explains what Ramadan is and
no,
how it works and
don't care.
Cuz I knew that you would have questions cuz you always do.
Don't care.
And I have like four pages.
Could not possibly care less.
Information about Ramadan.
I'm just trying to find my thank you for clarifying, by the way, that not every Muslim is stoning a homosexual today, though. I'm trying to find the thing of Obama saying, assalamu alaikum. Oh, here we go.
Assalamu alaikum.
There we go. If only I'd had that like 5 minutes ago. All right. And so forth. Is that the end of the Ramadan things?
Sure.
No. Wait, but how long does Ramadan last?
30 days.
30 days. Okay, so
it begins at sunset tonight.
So we can continue to revisit this every day and try to put that song in people's heads.
And I will keep this list of questions and answers about Ramadan handy.
Please don't.
For when you you say, but what's the deal with Ramadan? And I can answer.
All right, fine. Just answer. No. Just give me one now. Just answer a question that I have. Act as though I have asked a specific question about Ramadan, and then give me the response.
Well, perhaps you wanted to know why they fast for 30 days from sun up to sundown.
Because they're crazy. Well, I'm sorry. There was a different answer. Okay.
It's to discipline their bodies and minds. The absence of food and drink and other pleasures provides a perfect opportunity to concentrate on prayer and worship. Not having the luxuries of life to hand makes it easier to reflect on life and be grateful for what we do have.
All right.
There we go. All right.
Are we at the end of this particular news story?
Yeah.
All right. This is just, you're doing one of those things, though, where jokes that I would make at the expense of another religion, you get all disproportionately snarky about. If I were to make a joke about nutcase Christians, you would have had no problem with it. But I make a joke about nutcase Muslims, and then you get that look on your face where you get all squinched up.
Well,
as though you sort of channel Air America for just long enough to be angry at me about something.
I guess because there is so much. You yourself are not an ignorant, angry man, but there is a lot of.
No, that's not true.
There's a lot of ignorance and anger about Muslims. And so it just seems like that sort of contributes to it when one makes a joke.
Well, there are. Look, I mean, there are places, Saudi Arabia, where homosexuals are you know, beheaded in public for no other reason than being homosexual. So it's not like that sort of thing doesn't happen in countries filled with hundreds of millions of people. And, you know, Saudi Arabia actually is, one might say, the figurative and literal Mecca of that faith. You know, that's where Mecca actually is, you know, and where stonings and beheadings do happen, where there are, in fact, religious police who will roam the streets at the behest of the government, which is also a theocracy, and which will beat women in the streets for dressing inappropriately. So, I mean, unless you can find me, like, you know, some some sort of reason why I shouldn't point that out and, you know, and mock it, you know, I'm just going to continue to do so. It just seems like one of those things that you shouldn't be offended over, but you're being offended at it because somebody told you you ought to be.
It's not even really that I'm offended. It's more that I just have these certain moments when I think, I wonder if we are contributing to divisiveness.
No, we're not contributing to divisiveness. We're pointing out the divisiveness, the divisions exist. Just by pointing out that something is there doesn't mean I'm contributing to it. Wait, are you saying that if I were to not point out that that sort of thing happens, that it would not happen?
No, but I think that just immediately responding to anything about Muslims by saying, and they behead homosexuals, kind of may, you know, again, it's reinforcing stereotypes.
No, because a stereotype is a thing that has no basis in reality.
Well, no, stereotypes have a basis in reality. That's where they come from.
I mean, okay, a stereotype.
But they're a gross generalization and often unfair.
Well, I don't know that any reasonable person who is listening to this program would think that I was suggesting that there was actually an iPhone application to help you stone infidels. And if someone did hear me and think, my God, did you hear that? There's an iPhone application that lets you stone infidels and homosexuals. If you think that, you know what? You're dumb in a way that can't be helped. Not you. But I'm saying a person who this is like the, you know, this sort of claim that Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck are bad for America because, you know, because they pass along half-truths and myth-truths and propaganda as fact. And my response is, you know what? If someone listens to Rush Limbaugh and takes him as anything other than just a carnival barker, like, that's stupidity that can't be cured. That's the same guy that's just going to hear his microwave telling him to go kill people later on that day. There's nothing that could be helped about that. That is an ignorance that is unsolvable and against which there is no defense. Because the guy who thinks that Rush Limbaugh is a truth teller, giving him the divine word of, you know, providence or whatever, that's the same guy who thinks that his Motley Crue record was telling him to chop up his grandparents and make them into a pie. Dumb people are just dumb people.
That is true. But at the same time, we are on the supply side of this equation, and we can make the decision not to spread, you know, divisiveness and hate and misinformation.
What show is it you think? You know, you were just making necrophilia jokes like 5 minutes ago, right?
Well, I don't think there's a whole lot of people that are out there like marching in the street and trying to vote legislation to harm innocent people.
Well, not now, Dawn.
Because, you know.
But if you continue to wield your influence in such a negative way.
That's true. I could cause necrophiliacs to suffer undue oppression.
It's just the idea that there is a specific. That my humor has to take like a left turn at some point and leave certain kinds of folks alone. Just because of what some idiot in Texas might think, in a wholly separate realm of existence.
And you absolutely do have that right to do that. I have the right to make my little wincy face.
Yeah, but it's retarded. I mean, that's just,
Did I shout, shut up, Rick Emerson, don't say that.
No.
I made a wincy face.
You don't do that. Just like yesterday, you never actually came out and said you were in a bad mood. It was just sort of self-evident in your mannerisms. It was to my way of thinking anyway, and from my observational standpoint on this side of the room here, it was a thing that was evident in any number of subtle verbal and completely nonverbal mannerisms and behaviors. That's all I'm saying.
Sweetie, are we having our first fight?
No, this is like our ninth fight. And it's always.
You know how the audience hates it when mommy and daddy argue.
But I'm just saying, there's just certain things that I shouldn't make fun of because I'm going to get the angry, like, Terry Gross face from you.
Does Terry Gross make an angry face?
Oh, you know that there is probably a facial expression that is found on the faces of every NPR host probably 8,000 or 9,000 times a day as they find things to be offended by. So,
well, it'll make you feel good. The text box is almost overwhelmingly on your side on this.
Okay, let me just say this. And if anybody was under the impression that I somehow believe that all Muslims are out, you know, what should we do? Well, I don't know. We could go play some miniature golf. We could behead homosexuals. We could go to Fry's Electronics. And that they overwhelmingly vote for beheading homosexuals. That was, in fact, a dramatic and comedic overstatement done for the purposes of satiric comedy. I wasn't really saying that that's the case any more than I'm saying, that every Mormon is just sitting at home stockpiling Jell-O and underage wives. Although that is a thing that I might, at some point wheel out of the Rick Emerson warehouse of comedy to try to amuse the people. For the love of God. Christ. All right. All right. Just be sure to maybe I could get you a series of signs you can hold up. Tell me when I'm veering towards some kind of comedic material that you might find objectionable.
You knew I was a bleeding heart liberal when you
signed
up with me.
I'm a bleeding heart liberal too, but it doesn't mean that I can't laugh at stuff. This is why we were talking. This is a little bit of backstory here. And by the way, we're never going to get the top five done today. So let's just be zen with that right now. This is like when, every time I get fired and Bruce Agler and I would sit around and go, well, I've been fired again, Bruce. Wherever shall I go? Whatever shall I do? And then we will run through at any given point in human history or in Portland in radio history. We'll run through at that point in time. What radio stations exist in Portland and who might hire me? And the answer is always that, no one will hire me, which is why we end up doing things like starting our own goddamn network from the ground up because, because it's just at this point, the number of radio stations whose content I would not clash with on a daily basis, it can be counted on zero fingers. I don't think it's a big secret. I think I mentioned this, actually, that the last time I got fired, when we got fired from KUFO, that I had what might be called very initial low-level conversations with some of the folks at KXL who had this idea that I don't mean to speak out of school here, so I won't identify anybody in this conversation, but I will say that I spoke to someone in a position of power at KXL, which is the Lars Larson station. And, God bless Lars and his success, and it's a tough racket and whatever. You can make a dollar talking on the radio, go do it. I find no fault with that. But KXL, I think, they feel as though they have been, they say unfairly, I say by their own doing, they feel as though they have been pigeonholed as being the conservative, right-wing reactionary nutcase station, largely because of the presence of Lars.
Well, and the rest of their lineup.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, sun up to sundown, that's kind of their bag. But they were looking to sort of balance that out and maybe broaden their audience a little bit. And so they were speaking to me about coming and maybe doing a little something there and doing a show or doing whatever or maybe co-hosting a show with somebody. And the conclusion they came to after doing a little bit of focus grouping was that I, to use your word from earlier, actually, Don, they found that I was, quote, so unbelievably divisive and alienating in terms of their audience, in terms of the people who knew who I was, who had any recognition of what I'd done in Portland, that there was just no way it was ever going to work.
As opposed to Lars, who's just a big fluffy bunny.
But the thing is, the people who are listening to that station, they listen now and they love Lars. Now, you're never going to get some damn hippie to listen to KXL. Some bleeding heart's never going to listen to them.
Yeah. To their demographic,
yeah.
You were
they've already got a group of people that's listening. And they're not worrying about liberals listening. But what they found is, and it's not like they spent thousands of dollars researching this, but they just did a little bit of a focus thing on it. What they discovered is if they put me or anybody else on, who is not even necessarily liberal, but who's just not conservative, that they would lose a large section of their existing audience. But they would never gain any new audience because the people who might listen to me will probably never tune into KXL regardless. Which is sort of exactly the same thing that came back every time we would talk to Air America. I would get fired and we would go talk to, and I'd say, hey, Rick Emerson is now available for whatever. But we found that Air America felt that I was far too conservative for their audience. And so here we are, in our own glorious studio, because I apparently have the unique ability to irritate everyone and to make no one happy. So I'm glad
That's
a gift. I can add you to that equation as well.
Wow.
Jesus. All right.
You know I love you. Yeah. You know I love you deeply.
Whatever. Don't fill the studio with your lies.
And, of course, your hate just feeds me and makes me stronger.
Thank you. Well, it's all part of following the Emperor's plan, Don. It's 2:43. Greg and Sarah are sitting out in the kitchen prepping. Doesn't mean we need to be done right now, but let's keep an eye on the clock. Let me just take a moment, by the way. If you've asked yourself, hey, this hate, by God, I love it. It really fills me up and makes me whole. It is my emotional sustenance to get me through the day's events. Who makes this hate possible? This hate is brought to you by a grant from, among other people, Michael Beatty. He is the proprietor of The Cleaning Solution. You can reach The Cleaning Solution at 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. 11. The cleaning solution is a locally owned and operated company, and he does, it's cleaning, but it's a specific kind of cleaning. It basically has to do with places where your feet are just tracking in dirt every day. And the thing is, sometimes you notice this, and sometimes you don't. It almost is worse when you don't notice the dirt coming in with your shoes. Because, like, if you step in some mud or some filth or some foulness outside, you're probably going to scrape your shoes off or maybe even just leave them on the porch. But if you don't notice that, you know, you just got dust and grit and grime and filth and foulness and, you know, and schmutz of all varieties being carried in on your shoes, on your boots, especially in your boots, because it gets up inside that, the tread and the tracks on the bottom of your shoes. You don't really see it, and it gets carried in little by little. And the next thing you know, just like a reverse anti-Dufresne, you are carrying in 45 pounds of dirt and rock from the outside that is spread all over your carpet. And so your carpet may not look dirty, but if you were to look at it before, you know, like 5 years ago, and then today, your carpet's got all that grime, and it's just lost the luster, and it gets, it gets a very sort of dim and dingy shade to it. So get it cleaned, get it looking good, and that way you don't have to worry about it. The next time somebody comes to visit, or the next time, you know, if you're thinking about selling your house, you're going to be showing your place off, and you just have it looking good, and they can maintain it for you as well, and it's a lot cheaper when you do that. So whether you got pet damage, or whether there's some sort of odors in the carpet, or whether you just want to keep it looking as good as the day you got it, you call Michael Beatty at 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. That is Michael Beatty at the Cleaning Solution. All right. Let's see. Do you want to do our religious nutcase watch here?
That just seems...
Or does that seem redundant at this point?
That seems hypocritical at this point.
I'm just saying, you were the one who wrote it on the board, by the way. For those who are playing the Rick Emerson home game, I actually didn't even pull the religious nutcase watch story today. I had no idea we were going to have one until I looked for the board and said, by God, Don, do we have two corpse watches and a religious nutcase watch? And you said yes, and I can only presume that's because you found a story about some religious person who was amusing in their misbehavior, and that you labeled as a religious nutcase watch so that we could do it.
I did indeed.
Well, let's do it right now then. Let's just roll that out, shall we? Why wait? I'm just sitting here. Someday we got to play this whole song, this whole Striper Battle Hymn of the Republic. It's awesome. And it's like 9 minutes long. Here is your religious nutcase watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
A Columbia, South Carolina man is on his way home after walking thousands of miles from the West Coast to the Midlands. His goal, he says, is to spread the gospel that changed his life. Tobias Steinmetz spent 5 years in the Marine Corps, serving a tour in Iraq, and now has walked about 2,500 miles, dragging a giant cross behind him.
I was about to say, well, this doesn't sound all that crazy. This sounds as though it's just a simple, everyday man going door to door to spread the humble news of the faith that has made him whole. But no, he's crazy.
I bought a one-way ticket to Los Angeles, flew over, and started walking with this cross, said Steinmetz. The 25-year-old traveled up and down hills, mountains, valleys, and desert. I've been walking 3 months. It's been about 87 days, said Steinmetz. Over his shoulder, he carries an 8-foot, 40-pound pine wood cross, spreading the message. When you're going down the road and you see a man with a cross, it's just a reminder of their faith, said Steinmetz. We all have a calling in our lives, and sometimes we need to step out of our comfort zone to pursue that calling. Steinmetz says his journey has been difficult at times, not knowing where he will stay or where his next meal's coming from. Tobias says it's the American people who have gotten him this far down the road. I thought he'd be sleeping outside every night, hungry every day, and here it is 3 months later, and I've never missed a meal. Most nights I've stayed in hotels, or people have blessed me with hotel rooms. When it comes to God, I've been in the right place at the right time, and I've seen amazing times of ministry coming out of making a wrong turn as well. Steinmetz says he's gone through 8 pairs of shoes and numerous earbuds for his iPod, which plays gospel music and Bible verses.
Shouldn't that be called? Never mind. I was going to make another iPod joke, and I'm not even really holding off because of the religious thing. I max out on that. I can't make 5 iPod puns in one show.
Tobias expects it will take another 2 days to walk to his home in Columbia, South Carolina, where he's finishing up school at the South Carolina School of Leadership.
Did you have difficulty not picturing Tobias Funke every time you said the word Tobias out loud that? So here's a question that I have, and this has nothing to do with this story or this guy. I don't know if MythBusters or somebody has done this or not. I have questions about this whole business of nailing people to a cross. It seems like that wouldn't hold a guy up. It seems like you would have to be nailing him somewhere else, like maybe through the wrist. But then you got the whole bone thing to deal with. You've seen Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
In Passion of the Christ, do they do it through the palm? I'm not trying to be horrible.
No, they actually do it correctly in Passion of the Christ. They did it through the wrist. And that's how it was actually done.
So it's like through the wrist, because it's like otherwise... But that doesn't make any sense either, unless you figure that the angle is such that it wouldn't be going through the side. It would actually have to then go, okay, all right, I'm not trying to be horrible, but the physics of that have always really puzzled me.
Yeah, the traditional photos and little tchotchkes of Jesus on the cross, you see the stigmata in the hands and on the tops of the feet.
Right.
And actually... they were actually nailed through their wrists and through their ankles.
And that's why the stigmata thing is always so hilarious to me.
I believe they were also tied with ropes to keep them more up there, too.
And because, the stigmata thing has always been, as much as that is clearly just some sort of external manifestation of insanity to begin with, it's also like an inaccurate form of insanity because it's in the wrong place. That's the thing that has always really puzzled me about that. It's interesting that you mentioned the being the rope, because in most biblical, in most visual depictions of that of the crucifixion story, there's Jesus who is on the cross and he's flanked by the two thieves, and the thieves are actually always depicted as being bound, not nailed. I don't know if this is a thing that maybe it's just like a Roman Catholic thing, or maybe it's just when I was going to school. The way we always heard it, and I don't believe this is actually biblical. I think this might just be some crap they were making up. This is like a DVD extra or something that they had added into the story, where we had always heard that Jesus was nailed as opposed to being tied to the cross the way that the other criminals were. Just to to really drive home the point of like, don't F with the Romans. There was not a thing that they typically did, that even when they did it to Jesus, it was not typically done, that it was a special punishment that was devised for him because he was considered to be such a menace to the state and so forth. It was done.
I don't know if that was the typical, punishment, but no, Jesus was not the only person who was ever nailed to a cross.
They should do that on MythBusters, where they have what's his name, Buddy or Chester or whatever that dummy is they use.
Buster.
They should just do so like a crucifixion thing, just to see if it would actually work. I would just be just in terms of science. I would be curious to know.
Well, apparently, and as somebody pointed out in the text box, and she's absolutely correct, a lot of the reason it was done that way, it was also a very slow, really excruciating way to die, because, I mean, not only are you dying of dehydration and starving to death, but it's also pulling on your body as your muscles and your bones and your tendons are basically tearing and your organs are kind of collapsing as your body is doing horrible things. It was a pretty nasty way to kill somebody.
You know what's phenomenally messed up about that whole thing? When I was a child, my parents gave me this children's Bible, and I remember being a big book, but I mean maybe it was just because I was a small person, but it seemed like it was about the size of a, it was like a largish hardcover, and it was sort of the greatest hits from the Bible. It was all like the creation story and the apple and the snake and the Noah's Ark and. And when Daniel was in the den of the lions and Nebuchadnezzar's furnace and all that stuff. It was just sort of all like the really like exciting like action sequences, the big set pieces from the Bible. And then it was illustrated with these really lavish paintings. And it was a very beautiful book in some ways. And again, especially this stuff like the flood and the lions. And it was, you're a kid and it's basically, it basically depicted as the Bible as one big adventure story. So it was, sort of an interesting way to get a kid sort of into the Bible. But the thinking back on one of the really, and it said on the back, like for ages, like 3 to 9. The really messed up thing is the crucifixion part had this like full page. It was actually like a gatefold almost, or like he folded it out like a Yes album cover. And it had Jesus hanging there, flanked by the two thieves. And of course, they're all like baking in the sun, and Jesus has got blood streaming down his face, and there's a crown of thorns, and he's got nails in his feet. And then there's like actual vultures sort of circling above them, and there's people in the crowd, and there's like that story about the guy who's like piercing the side of Jesus with a spear. And it's sort of being rendered in this book that is like one step above a pop-up book that they bought to give me when I was a kid. It really is a miracle that I'm not even like more warped than I am already. It is not astonishing that so many people who are raised in hyper-religious households just end up being just flat-out screaming bonkers. I mean, that's a bizarre. It's a bizarre little human tick that we've got going on there.
The whole religion thing. Yeah.
All right. Well, we got like 5 minutes here. We'll have to do the top five tomorrow, sadly. And I hate to be that. I really fully intended to get to it today because it's awesome. I'm going to make sure that I flag the appropriate page here. Hold on a second. Let's get the bookmark. So let's do this. Let's do two more and then we will wrap it up. For today. Don't forget, joining us on Friday's program, Mr. Big Jim Willig, who some of you remember from being on the Marconi Show on KUFO, later host of his own program, and he is a stand-up comic of some note here in Portland. Funny guy. He's going to be opening for Gilbert Gottfried on Saturday, I believe it is, at the Aladdin. I was planning to have him in anyway, just because he's a good guy, and he's hilarious, and I haven't talked to him for a while. So we are going to have Jim Willig joining us on Friday. Tomorrow, though, is Thursday, and I'm not entirely certain what's happening tomorrow. It could just be more of the amusing interactions between Dawn and myself as we attempt to navigate the emotional minefield of our relationship. So you'll just have to tune in and find out. Here's Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
Former World Wrestling Entertainment executive Linda McMahon is one step away from the U.S. Senate. She's won the Republican primary in Connecticut and will face Attorney General Richard Blumenthal in November. McMahon has had to defend herself from the steroid scandals that have plagued pro wrestling.
Let's see. This is McMahon number one. Where did I put that? Right here.
And if my opponents continue to talk about the soap opera...
Is she going to make a wrestling pun? What do you think?
Probably.
I'm like 5-1. Yeah, 5-1. You know,
and I'll take him down. Yeah. With
and
a
if
scissor.
The, my opponents continue to talk
the
about
slam
the
their
soap
candidacy.
Opera content instead of focusing on the issues, I'll win again in November.
Oh, okay. Well, guess not. Good for her.
She'll face Attorney General Richard Blumenthal in November. McMahon explains why she believes she'll come out on top.
And I apologize. I actually don't think that cut works. I think that one, that file got corrupted somehow. So
that's where she probably did the pun, and we missed it.
Yeah, probably. So she's McMahon's wife, and she's running for what is the office again?
Senate.
Okay. Now she hasn't already. When she says run again in November, she's just talking about the primary. Right?
Well, she won the Republican primary, and will. Against the Attorney General in November.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing: I don't know anything about her really, except a little bit that I've read about this story. But anybody with the last name of McMahon coming from that family, I immediately have total faith in them. I have absolute faith in their ability to get the job done. If you ever want to just read a fascinating, and I don't know if he was working on an autobiography, and I don't know that it's out yet or not. But just a kind of a fascinating life story. I mean, really, just one of the great American entrepreneurs of all time is Vince McMahon. I mean, that guy is just you talk about a guy who just took something that was relegated to the backwoods and made no demonstrable amount of money and had no real mainstream impact in America, and then just not only crossed over but made it an entrenched part of multi. Just myriad different forms of American entertainment, where it is now, it now crossed over in a firmly entrenched way with music and video games and movies and television, not unlike country music did in the early 90s. So Vince McMahon is just a genius. I mean, he really is, so forth. All right, let's do one more here.
Celebrity cult fashion label Ed Hardy has gone into voluntary administration in Australia.
You own some things from Ed Hardy, Don?
I own one little notebook that I bought at Walgreens and didn't realize it was Ed Hardy until after I'd bought it.
Tell me about Ed Hardy, because I don't understand. When you and I and Cheryl were having lunch at one point, and you said we were going to write some things down. You said, well, let me take out my notebook. And you took out this spiral notebook, and then you apologized. You said, yes, this is an Ed Hardy notebook. I didn't know that when I bought it. Yeah. And I didn't know what that meant, and I still really don't know.
Ed Hardy is this designer who basically took these sort of poorly drawn knockoffs of classic tattoo designs and put them on T-shirts and shoes and handbags and things and charged a ridiculous amount of money for them, turned them into like some sort of couture must-have sort of item, which it's one of those things that then trickled down to become one of those things that middle and lower class douchebags also have to own. So you see like a lot of really douchey guys in $45 Ed Hardy t-shirts. And now it's everywhere. It's like there's like, you know, $80 Ed Hardy sneakers that you can get at Hot Topic and stuff like that. But it's just he's plastered his name all over this thing basically by using this whole, you know, like I said, poorly drawn knockoffs of classic tattoo designs.
So it's sort of a mass reproduced version of a much better thing.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
okay.
Pretty much.
Okay.
He's gone into the Australian operation has gone into what they call voluntary administration, which is a British sort of bankruptcy protection sort of a thing. The company appointed a law firm as voluntary administrations of Ed Hardy operations. The appointment only relates to Ed Hardy's operations in Australia and not the Ed Hardy Group internationally. The man who was speaking, Simon Wallace Smith, said the brand was hurt by slowing sales and competition from other retailers. The two stores in Queensland, a north-southwest store, a South Australian outlet, will be closed in Australia. Customers will not be able to redeem vouchers or pick up stock. The brand was inspired by the tattoo artwork of Don Ed Hardy, a Californian known as the godfather of the modern tattoo, which I don't know if that's true or not. It burst onto the global fashion scene in 2005 and was worn by celebrities such as Madonna, Britney Spears, and David Beckham. The brand has also inspired a vocal hate movement on the internet, with many fashionistas offended by its loud designs. A Facebook group, Friends Don't Let Friends Wear Ed Hardy, has more than 14,000 members.
The only thing I can think of is that with this story, because I've only seen, I think, a few of his designs, sort of knowing they were his, and I think it started when you pointed out the notebook to me, is just how glad I am at least that we have somebody new to hate instead of that Paul Frank guy who makes the weird monkey stuff,
yeah,
which I just loathe for no readily apparent reason. Like, there's no reason I should hate it. It's not like it's done anything to me. It didn't come and assault my family. But I just despise it for reasons I can't really quantify.
I tell you though, Ed Hardy's one of those companies though that you can't. Again, you gotta kind of admire the fact that these are people that are cashing in as quickly as they possibly can, knowing that interest in their crap is going to fade. There's an Ed Hardy wine now. They will license anything. And so they don't seem to be. And now we are watching the beginning of the end of Ed Hardy, apparently.
Well, that's that is the lesson of American business. You just saturate it and soak it for every nickel you can. Because you were talking about licensing wine. You know, Bob Dylan now has a wine out. But Bob Dylan put his wine out. I saw an interview with his business manager where they put his wine out, and it's like Bob Dylan labeled, you know, Cabernet or whatever the hell, because he saw that Kiss had put out their own wine. Kiss, by the way, which is now entirely populated with people who don't drink at all. So you figure if you can make any money there, you know, that is the Gene Simmons method. It doesn't really matter whether you like it. You don't put what you like to eat on the hook, Don. You put what the fish like to eat on the hook, as he would probably say.
Good point.
That's what I do. All right. We got to end this because
you're so wise, Rick Emerson.
Don't try to paper over the fissures that have developed in our relationship today, Don. It really is fine. I'm ready to go home and worry about it or whatever. You and I, Don and I, we really have to get out of here in a second because Sarah and Greg are in the kitchen. But
you know why we have to make up, by the way, today?
I don't.
It's Ramadan.
Thank you.
It's Ramadan.
And after yesterday's show, because I think you'd just been in a bad mood about some other stuff yesterday. There were the things that had happened, I guess, elsewhere in your life that had just sort of put you in a grumpy mood. And all during yesterday's show, I could kind of tell that you were irritated at something, and I was like, "Is it me? Have I done something? Do I smell? Did I inadvertently? Did I say something offensive this morning? I don't think I did." All right, I'm going to obsessively go over every single thing I said to Don while we were preparing for the show this morning. Wait a minute, maybe I didn't show up early enough. Maybe I showed up too early. Maybe I was here so early she didn't have alone time and she wasn't able to center herself before we started. And meanwhile, you're doing the show, and in the back of my head, I'm just running like this sort of diagnostic program on everything I did that morning, seeing how I might have offended you. And then it turned out later it was a wholly separate thing.
Yeah, nothing to do with
it. So we were just talking after the show, and I was making the observation that it's always better just to sort of be upfront about the fact that one of us or both of us is in a bad mood, or like if you've done something that just annoys me to no end, that you just have to say it, because otherwise it just sits there and it just builds up into this big building thing, and then it's never any good. But now we can end the program on a hearts and daisies note.
Yeah.
So there you go. And this is all true. So we got to end it now. We'll be back tomorrow. We want to thank Kelly Clark from Willamette Week, who was our guest today. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the love-filled studios of the Emerson News Network. And the news desk is Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. Have you spread the word lately? Do it now. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Wednesday, August 11th, 2010, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. We have a brief musical interlude coming up next, after which we will encore today's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program on the 24/7 stream. Thanks for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded.